All right. Ooh, I should try to check my mic.
Good morning.
That's better.
It's good to be with you this morning. I'm excited to preach in this series that we're calling Who Needs God? As we're taking this deep dive look into Ecclesiastes, and as you could see by what Pam just read, this guy is a little different kind of a voice than a lot of the rest of the Bible. Sometimes we feel like he's on our side, sometimes we're working against him. He's just kind of back and forth, and it's been an interesting several weeks that we've been kind of living in this book. And something interesting for me is Ecclesiastes actually goes back with me pretty far. When I was a youth, if you would have asked me what my favorite passage of scripture was, I probably would have said Ecclesiastes 3 for a long part of my childhood, which is a weird thing for a kid to say. Part of it is because I just like being different, I think. But it's that Ecclesiastes 3 is that section where we get a time for everything poem, right? A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to uproot. And this is kind of like weird, cynical, cryptic look at life and everything that's going on, and what is God really trying to say by that? That was confusing and interesting to me, and it's always been a book that has just kind of fascinated me. So it's a unique voice, to say the least, that we hear. As Pam read for us, this perspective that we hear, we've been calling the teacher. Some translations call him the preacher, but it's this Solomon-like, or maybe Solomon himself, kind of character who's aging and reflective, kind of this wise old man who's looking back on his life, and he's taken the time to kind of count everything up, add everything up, calculate and evaluate all he has seen. And he has for us kind of sometimes these solemn, maybe a little dark, maybe a little blunt observations about life and challenges for us that he's trying to draw our attention towards. And so some people have called this voice, this perspective, the critic. And I really like that. I think that really fits kind of the tone that we hear coming from Solomon and from this voice. And so I might refer to him a lot today as the critic as we go through. And I think it fits especially what we're going to be talking about today. So the critic has been taking us kind of on a tour, like a tour guide on this quest for meaning that we've been on. And we've been looking at different things like money and success, wisdom itself, or our careers, pleasure, family, relationships, all kinds of these things that some of them maybe are good and noble pursuits, but maybe in and of themselves they're not enough to really fill and satisfy and give us that deep sense of meaning in life that we're all longing for and looking for. And the critic has kind of helped us really see that these are all not going to work. There we go. Life under the sun, so far we've found that possible paths that we've checked to meaning, they've proved to be fruitless. And they're not going to get the job done. The math doesn't check out for the critic. So for many of us, though, some of these things we still get hung up on. Sometimes these different pursuits can creep in our lives, and they can become more important than keeping Jesus at the center of things. And so we still struggle with these things, and it was good for us to hear the critic's voice kind of point us through the negative side of these things and looking at really picking apart how these things work. And hopefully as we've done this, we've also been able to kind of redefine and reshape how we view these things, not as a path towards meaning or purpose, but as a part of just maybe a piece of the puzzle that God can put together in our lives to really find the full picture of purpose and meaning that he wants us to see. So as we kind of start to wrap things up a little bit with this series, we have me this week and Adam next week to kind of finish us out with this. We're going to kind of turn towards the other side of the spectrum, where we're going to be looking not just at paths toward our quest for meaning, but we're going to be looking at things that maybe hold us back from finding our meaning or living our best life or figuring out what God has for us. And what we're going to be looking at are things that I'm going to call purpose prohibitors, okay? And we're going to look at how these things keep us disconnected from God and each other. And the first one, they're really cheery, bright things. So yes, there's forces and realities in the world that are working against us in this quest for meaning. The first purpose prohibitor is that the inconsistency in life that we see leads to constant injustice. When we look around our world, things are upside down all over the place. If anything, we could say life is predictably unpredictable. We heard the critic saying, a wicked person who commits 100 crimes may live a long time. The righteous will get what the wicked deserve, and the wicked get what the righteous deserve. Things are upside down sometimes in this world. Just because you do the right thing doesn't mean that good things will happen to you. This inconsistency that we see around us, both in small ways and big ways, can drive us crazy. And it kind of starts on the level of realizing this great phrase, right? That life is not fair, okay? Right? Every parent's favorite thing to toss back at their kid who's complaining, right? Life's not fair. Get used to it, okay? This is the deal. The critic would love that way of thinking. It's hard for us as kids to realize that I have toys and I have to share them. Like, this is what if I share it and the kid breaks it? Like, there's so many unfair things that can happen to us in life. Our 3-year-old son right now doesn't understand why, if there's a full plate of brownies, he can't just continue to have more brownies. Like, that's unfair. It's not okay. And so there's things we learn and we go through life. We don't always get our way. We don't always get what we want. Things don't go how we want them to go. I've been the middle school pastor for 5 years now here, and middle school, there's just a whole lot of unfairness going on in middle school, from puberty and the timing of how that all works, to the way friends and peers treat each other during that phase of life, to even something like not getting the right teacher or being on the right team in school, feeling like you don't have your friends with you can change your school experience and just be incredibly unfair, and feel like maybe something out there is working against me, something is not on my side. And a lot of us, I think, feel that way. But how do we hold this together? How do we hold together this reality that life is unfair, but we serve and worship a God who is just, a God who is good, a God who is righteous and holy? How do we hold these two things together? Because these unfairnesses can become a huge deal for us. Sometimes it's a promotion that you didn't get that you sure you would have at work. Sometimes it's knowing someone got credit for something that they didn't actually deserve. Maybe it's family dynamics or decisions that leave you shaking your head. There's something inside of us, though, that when we encounter a situation in life that's not right, it just bugs us as humans. It gets inside of us and it eats us up, and especially when that not right thing that we might experience in life is directed at us. And in chapter 8, verses 2 to 4, actually just before some of the selections that Pamela started reading, the critic gives us an interesting example of how this problem can exist within authority, within kings, within governments, within your boss at work, okay? Authority can be corrupt, can be a source of oppression in this world, obviously, right? But listen to how he describes the situation. He says, "Obey the king's command. I say, because you took an oath before God, do not be in a hurry to leave the king's presence. Do not stand up for a bad cause, for he will do whatever he pleases. Since a king's word is supreme, who can say to him, 'What are you doing?'" Right? There's this complicatedness to relationships with authority when they're not doing the right thing. Sometimes we feel like we don't even have a voice that we can stand up and say what we need to say. Sometimes planting our flag in the sand and saying, "You're wrong, this is not right." Sometimes that's not necessarily the right thing to do. Sometimes it's more nuanced. Sometimes it's more complicated. Sometimes we have to come alongside the situation. Sometimes we have to play for the long game. These situations, the author wants us to know that we can't run from these situations. We can't just avoid them. We can't rebel against them and live in blatant disobedience to unjust authority. We've got to find a wise, discerning path to help us figure out and navigate all these things that we see going on around us, from authority situations, from the injustices of poverty and all kinds of war going on in our world today that we see constantly, we're bombarded with in the media. We've got to find a new way forward. And Solomon is pointing us in that direction. The critic's voice is very strong on this. So the second purpose prohibitor is kind of the reverse of it. If anything is constant in life, it's the reality that we are all going to die. Right, bright and cheery for Sunday morning. There's inconsistency to it. Whether you were a good person, whether you were a terrible person, whether you were on fire for God and doing incredible things, it doesn't matter. At the end of the day, we're all going to end up in the grave. Whether you believe that there's life after the grave or not, the only thing anyone in the church or outside the church can agree on is this is the future that we all hold, and it's something we have to wrestle with. It's something that death is something that comes for all of us. And it's something that kind of uniquely really shakes us up, I think, rattles our cages when we're confronted with that, maybe the death of a loved one. And we've sang hymns and read verses that tell us that death, where is thy sting? And we claim that truth about Jesus. But we know still in this world, we're walking through times of pain where the sting of death is still very real. This week is actually going to be the anniversary, ninth anniversary of when my wife, Kristen, lost her first husband to brain cancer at the age of 30. He was an incredible man of God with passion for music and life, left behind Kristen and their three young kids, who I've been blessed to be able to become a part of that family now, and it's been cool to see what God has done in us and through us. But there's just something that's raw when we see death that seems senseless, that seems like we can't explain it, we don't understand why God would be doing what he's doing. It really, really, really causes us to realize that life under the sun is challenging. Life under the sun is difficult, and we are all victims of these experiences under the sun. We all resonate with these things. You all have your own stories of how death or sickness has impacted your lives. We have moments where we're saying, why me, God? What is going on? How can this make sense? Questioning him. And one Bible commentator I read put it this way. He said that this is really the whole point of Ecclesiastes. He's trying to get us to this place where we realize we are not in control. We are not God. And this needs to be the way that we kind of help to reposition ourselves towards him. We can't ignore in all of the stuff that's going on around us. We can't ignore, and we can't sweep it under the rug, these harsh realities of the world we live in. So Ecclesiastes points us to this in verse 11 of chapter 9, where he says, it doesn't matter who you are, it doesn't matter what abilities you have, where you come from, time and chance are going to happen to all of us. And at some point, your time will be up, and at some point, your chances will run out. So what choice do we have? You know, we're all victims of life under the sun, so we could seek an advantageous alignment with something that's beyond the sun, right? And for many people, this could be chance and fate or destiny, the universe, some form of religion. If we would lean into luck, you know, and chance, maybe eventually our number will come up and we can find a way to play the system and get things to work out in our favor. Or maybe we can find someone or something that can help us decipher our fate and read the stars and understand what choices we should make. We'll cling to anything as humans that promises hope of a better tomorrow or improved circumstances. It's really a lot of what religions around the world are built upon. It's connecting with a supernatural being or entity who maybe could hopefully improve my state of life or help win me some favor or just help us improve our situations. I think there's a serious caution here that Ecclesiastes is trying to show us. He wants us to realize that the God of the Bible is different than that. That we don't seek relationship with him. We don't come to worship him so that we can avoid or be rid of tragedies and sorrows that happen in our lives. And if that is your primary way of connecting to him in hopes of him changing your circumstance, then you're missing out on a God who's much bigger and beautiful and complex than that. And don't get me wrong, because I think if it worked that way, this God would probably be a lot more popular, right? There'd probably be even more people in our pews this morning if coming to church meant that your life circumstances would automatically change and there was a promise and guarantee that you wouldn't have to face some of these harsh realities and inconsistencies that the critic is observing for us. Then probably it would be an easier thing to get people coming in our doors. But the thing you're missing out on is that God, our God, is not as concerned about changing your circumstances as he is about changing you. He wants to grow people that love and depend on him and can be a light in our dark world. And if we are the light of the world, which is what Jesus called us, then what better way to witness to the darkness than as ones who have experienced and walked through dark times of our own and maybe even continue to do so now, but from this perspective of having experienced the light. Think about it this way. If you've ever walked through a dark room at night, maybe it's a room you're unfamiliar with. Maybe it's a room where there's some toys on the floor. Maybe it's your kid's room and there's toys on the floor or clothing and you're not sure what's all in there. You're trying to navigate. You're stepping on things and tripping over things. It's just a terrible, terrible experience, frustrating experience. But all you would need is a light switch or a flashlight, and it would completely change how you were able to navigate that room. The mess is still there. The problems, the obstacles are all still there, but we can navigate it differently. And being able to experience that as Christians is part of what it means for us to be able to be the light of the world and come alongside people who are experiencing those same obstacles. But it's hard. And we understand that even if we understand all this, we realize that victim mentalities can creep into our lives. The other kind of option we have as victims is to get to the point where we start to blame or reject personal responsibility. I know you're good, God, but this is too much. Something's got to give. I've been praying and praying and praying, and nothing is changing. What's going on? Don't you hear me? Don't you see me? And instead of leaning towards him, we start to push back on him, and our trust begins to erode. It can even start to sound like, God, you made me this way. You put me here. Like, this is your problem. It's not my fault. How can you expect me to overcome this? Ecclesiastes is urging us to be careful. He's saying, look, there is obviously this vacuum of meaninglessness to the life that we live in. And it's easy to get sucked into it. And he's saying we've got to be prepared. And we've got to understand how this life works. And we've got to be able to look it in the eye and trust God and lean into his goodness and his perfect will, even when everything is going the opposite way we want it. And so we got to be ready, because the victim mentality can become an instant eruption in our lives if it's triggered by trauma. When we encounter serious, serious hard things in life, we can be shook to the point where we're just like, that's it. I'm done. That's enough. I'm walking away. I can't handle this anymore. In middle school, we purposely try to get the kids to start asking those hard, hard questions, because we need to realize that before we encounter these trauma experiences that the answers to the questions we have, we may not like them. The answers to the questions we have might be hard to understand, and the answers, there at some point, there might not be an answer to the questions we come up with. But yet, if we are doing this and asking these questions and growing together in the context of a safe and loving community, while we're all leaning into God and trusting him together, somehow, in the midst of those unanswered things, God can meet us there, and he can reveal to us his beauty and depth and mystery in a way that causes us to worship him more rather than to blame him. And the reality is, though, that there's lots of situations in life that we'll never be able to prepare for, things that we just can't plan for. And Ecclesiastes is trying to warn us that we need to make sure that we're building a faith on a firm foundation. We want to build our house on the rock, right? We don't want to build our house in the sandy land. We want to build our house on the rock to be able to weather the storms. But the other thing is that victim mentality can creep into our lives in an imperceptible erosion that's hidden in humility. It's kind of the opposite. It's this slow, slow trickle over time. It's the steady, slow and steady rain rather than the big storm. It's allowing things to eat away at our attitudes and our actions and allowing ourselves to drift away from God. We can hide in church pews and pretend we're just going along with the flow. You know, we can project it's almost a certain kind of false humility that says, I'm okay, I'm all right, you know, I'm content, I'm going to be okay. I'm going to keep my head down and not complain and just say the right church things to the right church people. But inside, we can grow cold and bitter and lose our zeal for God. And a lot of it is because somewhere along the way, we think God forgot us, or he never came through in the ways we were hoping he would. He never changed your spouse in the way you thought he would. He never blessed you with what you thought he would give you. Or he never helped you restore the relationships with that friend or family member in the way that you hoped he would. We go through all these emotions, and we experience all these things, and if we don't deal with them and don't talk about them inside, we can end up living like we're victims of life under the sun. Ecclesiastes is desperately trying to get our attention. He's saying, we've got to talk about this stuff. You know, we've got to be honest with ourselves. We've got to acknowledge it together and deal with these things. We've got to frame the way we approach the stuff the way that God wants us to. And that's why we want to flip to the other side of the coin. And we want to realize that in this life, we are not just victims under the sun, but we are victors in Christ over life in the Son of God. Because of what Jesus has done, we can claim victory with him, and we can come and approach life in a totally different way, understanding things through the lens of what he did for us on the cross. But the kind of victor that I think we think about, when we think about this victor mentality, I think it's a complicated thing. Because I think in our culture, when we think about victors, we think about the strong overcoming the odds and the pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps and staying positive and just persevering and not letting anything get in our way. Kind of very individualistic, overcoming, claiming victory. And those are definitely forms of victory, but it's not quite that same picture that we get of Jesus in the way that he took victory on the cross for us. So I want to look at the way victory is kind of set up with the critic and with Jesus. I think they're on the same page about this. So if we're all victors over life in the Son, we should be able to embrace and enjoy life in the midst of our toil and pain. In chapter 8, verse 14, the critic kind of re-ups on his claim of, you know, everything is meaningless, everything is crazy, all right? We can't figure this out. What's it worth? But then in verse 15, he follows it up saying, "So I commend the enjoyment of life, because there is nothing better for a person under the sun than to eat and drink and be glad. Then joy will accompany them in their toil all the days of the life that God has given them under the sun." And this is not the critic saying, well, life's crazy, just eat, drink, and be merry, have fun. He's saying, no, if these two things are true, right? If life is crazy down here, and the inconsistencies and injustices and hardships and suffering that we face, if that is our reality that we can't run away from or hide from, and we have a God who is just and good and loving, then there's got to be space for us. There's got to be space for us to be able to bring those things together, that we can find joy in the midst of whatever circumstance we find ourselves. To be able to eat and drink and be merry, be thankful for gifts that God has given, to be able to see God's handiwork wherever you can see it. And there's something about this concept that I think is driving, the critic is driving us toward this place of deep contentment, to be able to experience deep contentment in our lives. And one of the commentaries I was reading was by Warren Wiersbe. He's one of my favorite authors, and he's kind of famous for his B-series commentaries. And I just thought it was a very helpful thing for me, but just simply the title he gave his Ecclesiastes commentary was profound to me. And he entitled his entire commentary, "Be Satisfied." All of this is pointing to us to find, be able to find a true point where we can trust God and be satisfied with God in exactly where we are. There's something incredible, I think, about our relationship with God when he gets us to that point that, you know, maybe there was a situation where we were really unsatisfied or troubled by, and we're praying for God to change our circumstances. There's something about the way that in the midst of that prayer and being in community and leaning into him, that he can morph and change what's going on inside of our hearts. We can get to a place where we're fully content and satisfied with who God is, even though that circumstance still hasn't changed. He can do things in us that teach us to rely on him and trust him in new ways. And it's a beautiful thing when that happens. And I have found in life that as soon as we are able to find contentment in a situation where we never thought we could, that ends up being the platform God uses to bring incredible blessings that we never would have expected, that we weren't even asking for anymore, beyond what you could think or imagine. Because we have to remember, in the midst of all this, in the midst of all the downer side of things where we've been kind of living today, this morning, God is still the good Father who loves his children and loves to bless us and loves to see us rejoice and live life to the fullest. So in the middle of our circumstances, we want to be able to find a way to embrace and enjoy our life because of who God is. And the last way we're going to look at this is that we should be able to face injustice and death with the vulnerability demonstrated by Christ. When it comes to being a victor in the midst of the hardest things, I think we need to remember Christ's example. When we look at all the injustice and death in the world, we have to remember that Jesus willingly chose to be vulnerable while he was being betrayed, while he was being disowned by his closest friends, disrespected and mocked by crowds of people that he served and cared for. And in the most unjust act of all time, they took an innocent man who loved this world while he walked on it with a love that it had never seen, and they declared him guilty and sentenced him to death. the torture and pain that he suffered in that process, he did it all on our behalf. He walked through all of that for us, and because of what he did, he can see us and know us and walk with us in our sufferings and temptations. And even though he was put to death, he overcame it and he rose again, and he was victorious. And that same power that rose Jesus from the dead lives in us. That's the kind of victor Christ is for us. And so we want to walk in that way. Ecclesiastes and Jesus would have been in good agreement when we look at Jesus' words in John 16:33 to his disciples, where he says, "In this world, you will have trouble." Right? That sounds a little Ecclesiastes-like. There is no way around it. We're not going to avoid it. We're not going to be able to understand it. In chapter 8, verse 17 of Ecclesiastes, he says, "I saw all that God has done. No one can comprehend it, what goes on under the sun. Despite all their efforts to search it out, no one can discover its meaning. Even if the wise claim they know, they cannot really comprehend it." We're never going to be able to fully figure out why we've been dealt the hand we've been dealt, why we're experiencing the things we experience in our lives, and why God is doing what he's doing. But we've been given enough in his word to be able to see that he is a good God, that he is faithful, that he does not change, that his love for us is relentless. So Jesus agrees with Ecclesiastes that in this world we will have trouble. But he finishes it off and he reminds us, "But take heart, for I have overcome the world." And Paul tells us we can stand with Christ as more than conquerors. So we're going to close our service today singing a beautiful celebration hymn, my favorite version of it, Victory in Jesus. But I want us this morning that just as much as we're celebrating what Jesus has done for us and claiming that victory and salvation in him, I want us to also think about this victor mentality and how it invites us to lean in to the suffering that we experience. For Paul, he was able to identify and connect this concept of suffering in our world to identifying with the suffering of Christ. We can do this as we walk through these things, and we can use this call to help us come alongside the world and the community around us to testify, to know that Christ is going to walk through whatever comes our way with us, and that he is empowering us with resurrection power to go out into the world and walk through these hard things, loving people the way that he loved, shining his light into the darkness. Let's pray. Dear God, we just thank you this morning for who you are. As we sung earlier, God, we know that your justice is like mountains. You are so good. You are so great. And you are so righteous. God, yet somehow this world is so messed up sometimes. Sometimes, God, things happen that shake us to our core and we don't know where to turn. God, help each of us to turn to you. Help each of us to find community and fellowship with people that can guide us and lead us in those times. God, help all of us who are so prone, like myself, to drift, to lose focus, to allow ourselves to grow bitter. God, you see us in our pain. You wept at Lazarus's grave even when you knew you would raise him from the dead. You care about our troubles and our problems, and you are with us through this journey. Help us to be the light of the world, your hands and feet, be willing to come alongside each other, our neighbors and our families, to point them to you, to enter into their experiences with injustice and death. And help us to build a firm foundation, that enduring faith, God, that we can cling to you and your promises and thank you for who you are, for the victory that you've given us. And we just praise you this morning. Amen.
Will you please stand?